Today is the Bible study that we have once a month, and I'm deviating. We were in the book of 1 Thessalonians, and I decided I will postpone continuing and finishing that until next month in April. I thought I would instead get into another subject here, as it's a time that we are approaching toward, as you heard, 3 weeks to the Passover. I have been recently reading from Mr. Armstrong's autobiography, which I find very interesting, well written. I appreciate it more as an older man today than when I was very young and first into the church. It's an autobiography that covers really the first volume covering his early years of his life, but he patterns it not so much about all himself, but in the things that he did before he was converted. He brings in the laws of success, 7 laws of success, a book that he later would write, trying to give information and things that way to the people as it ran serially and the Plain Truth in those years, I think in the 50s it was. But from the time of his conversion on, it's really quite interesting when you read and how they came into the church and the things that happened, because then it's a beginning to be a history of the church and the work and how the work grew. And it's not just something about himself, but it's about how the work developed. Very interesting. I had a person call me here this week. When was it? A couple of days, 3 or 4 days ago, and actually never gave me his name. But in the course of the conversation about our church, what we believe in, everything, he said, "Well, no, were you ever connected with Herbert W. Armstrong?" And I said, "Yes. We trace all of our roots today of the modern church back to him." And so he said he was very pleased to hear that. I hope he might be somebody who might come along again later. Actually, it was up in Jupiter is where he was from. But I did have a visit a week ago with another person here in Miami who likewise quite interested in going through and very candid with him and talking about everything of the church and where we came from. I say this because it'd be good if you haven't read it in a long time. You might want to go back and review it. I find it fascinating and interesting. I think the most interesting part is from the time of his baptism conversion through the 30s and into the 40s of what would become, as we would all call it, the work of the church. I want to take something, that's not what I want to talk about here today, I'm just beginning with this, but I do want to talk about something that he brings up that took place in 1940, when the radio broadcast went into Seattle, Washington for the first time. Before that, he was on only 2 stations, one in Eugene and one in Portland, Oregon, KWJJ Portland, Oregon, which happened to be the station I listened to him on in 1963, and we were on there one of the longest periods of time that I can think of. But you'll see where I'm going with this here in just a minute. He has a subtitle here, Atheist Converted. This bulletin, he had a monthly bulletin to the co-workers, carried a subhead on page 5, Even Atheists Being Converted, referring to the growth of the through the broadcast. It said, quote, "Yes, even atheists, those who have convinced themselves there is no God, seldom if ever have you heard of atheists being converted, yet I know definitely of at least 2 who have been changed from death to life through this work of which you are a vital part, and both are active co-workers now. One was a young mother prominent in the Communist Party," and earlier he writes about it. "The fact is, the facts in her case have been covered previously in the autobiography. The second was a young man in Vancouver, Washington. I reported in this bulletin, last February 16th, we received this letter, the first we had ever heard of this young man. Quote, Dear Mr. Armstrong, I started listening to your broadcast in September 1938. And since that time, I have been coming to my senses. In other words, you have been the medium through which God has acted to blast away my atheistic ideas, false conceptions, and idiotic philosophies. This, to me, is a modern miracle, for I have long considered myself impregnable to what seemed to be the greatest myth of all time, God and the Bible. I've been listening for a long time to various pastors, ministers, and preachers, if only for the malicious pleasure of finding fault with what they say. And the first time I tuned on you, I was stuck. And then I started thinking, probably for the first time in years. Then I started regretting. I didn't deserve it, but found the door open when I knocked. It's marvelous how much different one's attitude is when it is taken from a spiritual angle. All things seem different. It's something that God only can do for a person, and I wish you could reach a much larger audience, and I'm praying for the time that when you can. It's quite a letter coming from this person who'd been listening for 2 years and had changed from being an atheist to a believer. Early work and the results of it. This man, reading on here, now Herbert Armstrong writing, this man, sometime after writing this letter, yet this was prior to going on the air in Seattle, he attended meetings I was holding in Vancouver, Washington. And he was baptized shortly after this bulletin went out on November 1, 1940. His prayer for the expansion of the work, along with many other prayers, was answered, and he became a valuable instrument of God, collaborating with me in God's work. And he was a nationally known artist. You know who it is. For many years, Plain Truth readers read his Bible story, which rendered the story thread of the Bible in plain, simple, dynamically interesting language. This man was Basil Wolverton. The letter quoted above was the first I ever heard from him. It gives evidence of some of the fruit God was producing through this work, even in those pioneer years. Really quite interesting. I didn't know that his baptism went back that far in the past. Now, I met Basil Wolverton when I began to attend church in 1966, and by that time he wasn't a young man. He had a number of health issues and problems. He was an elder in the church, but was not able to serve as much because of those health problems. But I always remember the few times I did talk with him that no matter how he felt, he was always very humorous with people and always tried to not be too serious in the sense, not that he was lighthearted, but he wanted to express himself in a way of being very humorous and relaxing people. And he had a great sense of humor. It's just all the, I just remember that in the few times that I met him. Now, when I grew up in outside of Portland, Oregon, as a teenager, I took Mad magazine. Maybe some of you remember Mad from years ago. I don't think it. You do remember it. Okay. Is it still in publication? I don't know. It is? Well, back in those days, I found out when I began to come to church in Portland in 1966, that those outrageous, incredible expressions on the cartoons were Basil Wolverton. They outsourced, apparently, to him to do a lot of the cartoons and writings and so forth for Mad and I guess other publications as well. So he was a very talented man. Well, Mr. Wolverton had to prove to himself that God and the Bible were true. He also had to prove that the greatest story ever told really happened. It is the central story of the Bible, and the authenticity of the Bible either stands if it is true or falls if it is not. It is the story that God became man, that he was put to death by man, and he was resurrected from the grave after 3 days. Now, throughout the ages, there have been many who did not believe it ever happened, including the Jewish people. We believe it did happen, but what evidence do we have that it happened? Basil Wolverton had, in the course of those years and before he was baptized, had to come to prove that it really did happen and take place. Well, today I would like to look at the biblical evidence for the crucifixion and the resurrection as we come into this time of year. Very important thing that we look at. We say, well, I've always believed it. Well, why do you believe it? Many of the skeptics say, well, there's not a whole lot outside the Bible about it, which shows that they don't know too much about the Bible by making such a statement. We're going to look at several things here today. Question. Did he really die or did he fake his death? Which people who think, well, there's not that much outside the Bible, he just faked his death. We're going to find out how many witnesses there really were. What is the evidence that his body was buried in a tomb and it was empty 3 days later? And finally, what is the biblical evidence of his appearing following the resurrection? Sometimes when people are skeptical, they talk about the Bible as if it's a single book with a single author. No, it isn't. It's multiple authors. And they quote multiple witnesses as well. And you can't just throw that out and say, oh, well, I can't believe that because it's in the Bible. Now, if something outside the Bible, then I might accept that. Well, there are those outside the Bible. Tacitus, the Roman for one, wrote about the worship of Christos and so on. And there were others, but they had none of the details. They just simply were quickly wrote in their writing something about it. It came to their attention as they were writing their histories. But as far as anything about it, they didn't know anything other than what they had heard themselves. All right, let's take the first question. Did he really die or could he have faked his death? Is it possible to have faked it and that the whole thing is a hoax? And that has been one of the major arguments. How would you answer the question? Think about that. How would you answer the question? Now, to answer this first question of the three I have here, I'm going to read from Lee Strobel's book, The Case for Christ. And actually, this is a review in this case because I have done it several years ago. And he quotes here, he interviews Dr. Alexander Metherall, who is quite a noted physician and a scientist of his own right, who has written about the crucifixion. And to answer that very question from a medical standpoint, did it happen or did it not happen? Could he escape this? Now, when you understand the details of the Roman crucifixion, I'll just tell you in advance, there is no way a person would have to be totally ignorant to say he was able to come down off of that either stake or cross and just walk away, and that he had simply faked it. There is, once you're there, the only way you're coming down is dead. There's no, you don't come down alive. And there's nothing in history ever indicating somebody came down alive and walked away. That doesn't happen. I'm getting ahead of myself. I'll just say, you know why not? Because the ones doing the execution, if such a thing could happen, they would be executed for letting the person get away. So that was not going to ever happen. But other things too. I think when you look at it from the medical perspective, is really quite interesting and showing how absolutely impossible such a doubt could possibly be. He begins here, first of all, with Luke 23 and in verse 43. The doctor does here to answer the question concerning the sweat and the blood as he prayed that night in the Garden of Gethsemane. Now, is that really real? And the doctor, of course, here answers and says, this is a known medical condition called hematidrosis, if I can say that. Hematidrosis, it's not very common, but it is associated with a high degree of psychological stress. What happens is that severe anxiety causes the release of chemicals that break down the capillaries in the sweat glands. As a result, there's a small amount of bleeding in these glands, and the sweat comes out tinged with blood. We're not talking about a lot of blood. It's just a very, very small amount. What this did was to set up the skin to be extremely fragile so that when Jesus was flogged by the Romans, soldiers the next day, his skin would be very, very sensitive. And of course, he would bleed much more. Now, this was at night after the Passover service out in the garden when they prayed. Well, the next day, sometime between 6 and 9 a.m. in the morning is when he was scourged. And of course, a great deal of bleeding would have taken place at that time. Well, what about this? The next morning, from a medical perspective and point of view, now we read in the script, by the way, you have four gospel accounts. What's interesting about that is you have four writers at four different times, and they're writing and agreeing, though they don't always have the exact same facts as the previous one did. Some may add something that the other one didn't have, but the point is, it did happen according to each of the four accounts. Some add, like I say, some details that others did not. Now, when it comes to the flogging, the cat of nine tail, all four Gospels, of course, talk about this. Matthew 27, Mark 15, John 19, Luke 23. What I'm going to do, though, is I'm going to turn to, not to all four of them, but I will just for a moment here turn to part of them, to Mark chapter 15 real quickly. Mark 15, and see what happened. And then I read, it's interesting listening to this doctor's explanation. What would this, if you and I had to go through this, what would we experience? I mean, this is the most barbaric execution and death that you can imagine. That our Savior did not come and just like nice and easy, like somebody shot him in the head and that was it. And no, it had to be this kind of a death to be worthy as a sacrifice for all humanity. The very one who created us and made us, as John 1 verse 3 says. All right, Mark chapter 15, just read the scripture, verse 15. So Pilate, wanting to gratify the crowd, that last statement is not in the other accounts, but I thought I'd read it. This is why he did it, how Mark received. Who did Mark get this from? Peter. Peter's the one that's telling him, and that's his source of information. Now, Matthew and John were there, but Mark and Luke were not, and they got their information from others. Luke, by the way, is a very good writer because he's excellent in the Greek language. And expresses himself very, very well in what he has to say. Now, let me read that again. So Pilate, wanting to gratify the crowd, released Barabbas to them, and he delivered Jesus after he had scourged him to be crucified. All right, what is this scourging? We all have heard that over the years. Roman floggings or scourgings were known to be terribly brutal. They usually consisted of 39 lashes, but frequently were a lot more than that, depending on the mood of the soldier applying the blows. The soldier would use a whip of braided leather thongs with metal balls woven into them. And when the whip would strike the flesh, these balls would cause deep bruises or contusions, which would break open with further blows. And the whip had pieces of sharp bone as well, which would cut the flesh severely. The back would be so shredded that part of the spine was sometimes exposed by the deep, deep cuts. And the whipping would have gone all the way from the shoulders down to the back, the buttocks, and the back of the legs. It was just terrible. One physician who has studied Roman beatings said, as the flogging continued, the lacerations would tear into the underlying skeletal muscles and produce quivering ribbons of bleeding flesh. A third century historian by the name of Eusebius, who's also called the father of church history, and I have his book and I've read from it to you in the past, described a flogging by saying the sufferer's veins were laid bare and the very muscles, sinews, and bowels of the victim were open to exposure. Really incredible. Anyone going through this, is he going to come down off of either the cross or the stake and walk away and fake his death? Especially when Pilate, in all four accounts, turned him over to please the Jews to have this done. We know that many people would die from this kind of beating even before they could be crucified. At the least, the victim would experience tremendous pain and go into hypovolemic shock. Well, he asks the doctor here, the author does, what does hypovolemic shock mean? Hypo means low, vol, V-O-L, refers to volume, and emic, E-M-I-C, means blood. So hypovolemic shock means the person is suffering the effects of losing a large amount of blood. This does four things. First, the heart races to try to pump blood that isn't there. And second, the blood pressure drops, causing fainting or collapse. Third, the kidneys stop producing urine to maintain what volume is left. And fourth, the person becomes very thirsty as the body craves fluids to replace the lost blood volume. Do we see evidence of this in the gospel account? Well, yes, we most certainly do. Jesus was in hypovolemic shock as he staggered up the road to the execution site at Calvary, carrying a horizontal beam of the cross. Finally, Jesus collapsed, and the Roman soldier ordered Simon of Cyrene to carry the cross for him. Later, we read that Jesus said, "I thirst," at which point a sip of vinegar was offered to him. Well, because of the terrible effects of this beating, there's no question that Jesus was already in serious to critical condition even before the nails were driven through his hands and feet. So again, when people want to say, well, he just faked this, you don't fake something like this. You are in no condition. He died from the loss of blood. He would have died from heart failure had it not been that the spear was plunged into him that finally took his life. I'll come to that here in just a little bit more about that. So once he has been flogged, now we go to the crucifixion site. Surely he must have been able to get out of that, because we know he could not have died and been resurrected, right? Well, let's take a look a little bit more at what took place once he arrived at that place. The Romans used spikes that were 5 to 7 inches long and tapered to a sharp point. And they were driven through the wrists, Metherell said, pointing about an inch or so below his left palm. Hold it, the author says, I thought the nails pierced his palms. And he answered, that's what all the paintings show. In fact, it's become a standard symbol representing the crucifixion. Now, through the wrists, Metherell repeated, this was a solid position that would lock the hand. If the nails had been driven through the palms, his weight would have caused the skin to tear and he would have fallen off the cross. So the nails went through the wrists, although this was considered part of the hand in the language of the day. And it's important to understand that the nail would be go through the place where the median nerve runs. This is the largest nerve going out to the hand, and it would be crushed by the nail that was being pounded in. Would he have had any pain when that happened? Well, the answer, and I'll just quickly say here, is that Metherell says, in answer to that, he most certainly did. Have you ever hit your crazy bone? If you hit it directly, that's the nerve you're hitting called the ulna, the U-L-N-A nerve, and it just about kills you for that to happen. That is exactly what happened when it went through here. Then once they had the hands nailed, then they had to go to the feet, right above, probably in the ankle to foot area where they would have driven the spike through. Interesting, and I'll just tell you without reading so much now, in 1968, archaeologists in Jerusalem discovered people who were executed by crucifixion at the time of the Romans overrunning the city in 70 AD. The resistance, I think it was 20-some bodies they found by crucifixion. And guess what? The spikes were just like he said here, that long and crushing through the bones. And of course, what he would have experienced through the hands with the crushing of the nerve was also doing the same thing to the nerve going to the feet. It was so painful, in fact, that they had to come up with a new term. And the term is excruciating. It means out of the cross. Think of that. They needed to create, the Romans did, a new word because there was nothing in the language that could describe the intense anguish caused during the crucifixion. And at this point, Jesus was hoisted as the cross was attached to the vertical stake, and then nails were driven through Jesus' feet. Again, the nerves in his feet would have been crushed, and there would have been a similar type of pain. I'm sure that he probably just screamed out in pain when those things went through. Can you imagine driving a 5 to 7 inch spike through your hands, through your feet, or right probably at the ankle area, I would assume is where it would have been. If you could come down off that, if they could take those spikes out, you couldn't, first of all, you couldn't walk. You probably would have lost your feet and ability to walk for the rest of your life if you survived that, if you were taken down before you actually died. And you wouldn't have had any use of your hands. They wouldn't have had anything to do any repair work or surgery to repair, if they could, nerves from such a thing as that. All absolutely incredible beyond any shadow of a doubt. And one last thing about the death on the cause of death in the crucifixion. I'd like to just share that with you as well. Once a person is hanging in the vertical position, he replied, crucifixion is essentially an agonizingly slow death by asphyxiation. He didn't die, but he came. If he had been allowed to stay there, he would have died that way. The reason is that the stresses on the muscles and diaphragm put the chest into the inhaled position. Basically, in order to exhale, the individual must be able to push up on his feet against the nails, so the tension on the muscles would be relaxed. In order to exhale, the individual must push up on his feet, so the tension on the muscles would be eased for a moment. In doing so, the nail would tear through the flesh or the foot, eventually locking up against the tarsal bones. Now, after managing to exhale, the person would then be able to relax down and take another breath in. Again, he'd have to push himself up to exhale, scraping his bloodied back against the coarse wood of the cross. This would go on and on until complete exhaustion would take over and the person wouldn't be able to push up and breathe anymore. So as the person slows down his breathing, he goes into what is called respiratory acidosis. The carbon dioxide in the blood is dissolved in carbonic acid, causing the acidity of the blood to increase. This eventually leads to an irregular heartbeat. And in fact, with his heart beating erratically, Jesus would have known that he was at the moment of death, which is when he was able to say, Lord, into your hands I commit my spirit, and then he died. And he says here, cardiac arrest, but I'll show you that's not correct. Now, if he'd been allowed to stay there a little bit, it would have been cardiac arrest. But that Roman soldier put that spear in him, and he bled to death. That was the final thing that killed him. I'll come to that here in just a moment. Now, the actual cause of death, and this has to do with, since it's a Bible study, let's take a look at a couple scriptures here that need a correction, because there are two scriptures that have a problem with in them. Let's go first to John chapter 19. John chapter 19, if you will. And we'll start there in verse 32, if I can get there. John 19. Now, notice in John 19, and let's start in verse 32. Then the soldiers came, and they broke the legs of the first and of the other who was crucified with him, okay? But when they came to Jesus and saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs. But one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and immediately blood and water came out. All right, John's account says that he was already dead, so they didn't have to break his legs, but nevertheless, they rammed the spear into him, and blood and water would come out. The water collected around the heart is what the water was. It wasn't his bladder. Now, if you go back to Matthew's account, Matthew 27. And hold your place here because we'll flip back and forth. Matthew 27 and verse 49. Matthew 27, verse 49. Actually, verse 48. Immediately one of them ran, and they took a sponge, filled it with sour wine, and put it on a reed, and offered it to him to drink. The rest said, "Let him alone. Let us see if Elijah will come to save him." And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up the spirit. Now, there's something was left out here between verse 49 and verse 50 in John's account. Early manuscripts show that what actually was written there, and I'll give you a source where you can go see it for yourself, what should be between the two verses. "And another took a spear and pierced his side, and there came out water and blood." Then, verse 50, he cried out. Does that make sense? Somebody that you would cry out and give up the spirit, as it says there. ancient manuscripts do show that this was part of it, that was there between verse 49 and 50. The King James Bible from the Byzantine text left it out. Some of you have the Harmony of the Gospels by Robertson, as you followed a couple years ago the classes on the Gospels being done either by Mr. Thompson, who was the other one later, well, at the present time at the classes at FI, Mr. Dave Myers does it. But on page 234 of that book, if you own it, you will see that there is the footnote that the ancient manuscripts add between verse 49 and 50, what I just read, "And another took a spear and pierced his side, and there came out water and blood." Why is that important? What about the prophecies of the Old Testament? Was he to die of a broken heart, of natural causes, or was he to be killed? let's go back here to Isaiah 53, which we read at the Passover every year. In Isaiah 53, and a couple verses, let's look at verse 7, 53:7 of Isaiah. "He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter," okay, "and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth." Now, when a lamb is led to the slaughter, does he die of a broken heart? Does he die of asphyxiation? No. He slit his throat and it bleeds to death. Look at verse 12. "Therefore I will divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul," or his life, "unto death." He poured it out. What did he pour out? The life is in the blood, right? He poured out he bled to death. "Because he poured out his life unto death, and he was numbered with the transgressors, and he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors." One other scripture in the Old Testament. Let's go to Zechariah chapter 12. Zechariah 12. And in verse 10, "And I will pour on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplication. Then they will look on me whom they pierced." Yes, they will mourn for him as one mourns for his only son, and so on. They're going to look on me whom they pierced. Did they pierce him while he was alive, or did they pierce him when he was dead? In Revelation 1 verse 7. It says there that those who pierced him will see him in the resurrection. Well, coming back, now let's go to John chapter 19 again and look at verse 34 and see what the problem is. Because John said he was pierced after he died. And when you add what was left out of Matthew between 49 and 50, it says he was pierced before he died. And the prophecies indicate he would die as a lamb is brought to the slaughter, he would be killed and he would bleed and his life would be spilled out of him in the blood. All right, the problem here in John chapter 19, verse 34, is that the wrong tense is used. In verse 34, it's an aorist in Greek, A-O-E-R-I-S-T, aorist past tense is what it's called. And it should be reading, but when the soldiers had pierced him, his side with a spear, and immediately blood and water came out. That is what's missing. It should be in the past tense, not in the present. But when one of the soldiers pierced him, it should be when he was pierced while alive, and he was brought to the slaughter like a lamb, and he gave up. His life came out of him, that is, his blood came out. Now, had that not happened, he probably would have died of asphyxiation unless something else took place, because he was at the point of death. And when he cried out, it's because he stuck a sword or a spear in him. I think anybody would. So just to reconcile that. And how did he die? He bled to death. And of course, he was dying from all the wounds and everything leading up to that, as you would well imagine. But the final blow is what took us. What is John actually saying here? John is showing the reason why his legs were not broken. Why would you break the legs? You want it to hurry up. You want him to hurry up and die because the Jews wanted him off the crosses and buried or whatever before the Passover, their Passover, the beginning of the Holy Day. When you break the legs, it does what? At the bottom here, they cannot lift themselves up to exhale. They die just in moments from asphyxiation because they have no way of being able to exhale. When they came to Jesus, they put the spear in him. In other words, and then they saw, of course, that the spear was not after he died. The spear was so that he would die. And it fulfilled the prophecy in Psalm 22 that not a bone in his body would be broken. And they were not. They were not. Very interesting. Well, anyhow, that solves the first question. Let's go on here quickly and to the other ones. Is there any doubt that he did not fake his death? No, he died. He definitely did die. There's no question about that. There's no way you could survive anything like this. The Romans, first of all, would never let you survive. And it would be death to them, to the executioners, if anyone possibly could survive such a thing. Second question I want to look at here, and these are questions and things that people in this church many, many decades ago had to look at. What is the evidence that his body was buried in a tomb and that it was empty 3 days later? Is there anything that we can look at? Well, normally crucified criminals were left on the cross to be devoured by birds, or they were thrown into a common or mass grave such as the Valley of Hinnom, which is probably where the two thieves on each side of him were put. So then what is the evidence that he was placed in a tomb instead of thrown down in the Valley of Hinnom to just as a common criminal? Well, the earliest record is the creed cited by Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Let's take a look over there at that. 1 Corinthians 15. Do you realize Paul was citing a creed that was quite commonly understood? And what's interesting about this, it is before any of the four Gospels were written. Which then means what? There is no time gone by for legends to enter into the story. Here in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, pick up my notes here, let's start in verse 3. Paul says, "For I delivered to you, first of all, that which I also received, from whom and where." We'll come to that in a moment. "That Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures." What scriptures? The Old Testament. Isaiah 53, Zechariah 12, and others. "And that he was buried, and that he rose again the third day according to the scriptures." How about Jonah? 3 days, three nights? And that he was seen by Cephas, then by the 12, of course that's Peter. And after that he was seen by over 500 brethren at once, of whom the greater part remain to the present, that some have, but some have fallen asleep. The present was somewhere between 55 and 57 AD, about 25 years after the resurrection. And the better part of 500 people are still alive. Not just one or two witnesses. After that, he was seen by James, who was his brother, by the way, and then by all the apostles. Then last of all, he was seen by me also as by one born out of due time. On the road to Damascus, that's when I saw him and his presence was before me. Now, going back to that verse 3, which I also received, when did Paul receive this that he's talking about? Well, turn over to Galatians. Galatians was written a number of years before 1 Corinthians was written. And here in Galatians chapter 1, verse 17 or 18, verse 18 of chapter 1. Then after 3 years, I went up to Jerusalem to see Peter and remained with him for 15 days. But I saw none of the other apostles except James, the Lord's brother. Now, the interesting thing about this is, see the word, three-letter word in verse 18, see. I didn't just go up there to look at him. The word is historia, historia, I'm sorry, H-I-S-T-O-R-E-O, historia. Now, what word do we get in our language from this word, this Greek word? History. What did it mean then? It meant to examine or investigate or seek information. So when you read here in verse 18, see the word see? After 3 years, I went up to Jerusalem to investigate, to examine Peter, and remained with him for 15 days. That is where he had the story given to him that he reports in 1 Corinthians 15. That's where the creed came from, how it was given to Paul. It was given to Paul here by Peter when he went up to Jerusalem. And this would have been actually just, three or four years after the resurrection. So this is understood clearly very early on had taken place. So there was no question about this at that time. All right, there's a couple other things here. Now, there are four specific accounts by four different writers at four different times about Jesus' burial. That his body was not thrown in the Valley of Hinnom. He was buried. And again, you'll find all four accounts, Matthew 27, Mark 15, Luke 23, John 19. I'm not going to read from all four, but I will read from John 19. Let's just go to John 19 and take a look at this. And they all say the same thing, except some will have a little more information than others. While you're turning there to John chapter 19, I'll just mention, let's read it first, then I'll mention about something on the others. John 19, 38. Where are we? Here it is. After this, Joseph of Arimathea, being a disciple of Jesus, but secretly for fear of the Jews, asked Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus, and Pilate gave him permission. So he came and he took the body of Jesus. When is he doing this? The day portion of the 14th, right? It's between 3 in the afternoon and 6 in the evening at sundown, somewhere in there. Very close. He's already died. Actually, he was killed by finally killed by the Roman spear. Verse 39, now look at this. And Nicodemus, who at first came to Jesus by night, also came bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds. Then they took the body of Jesus and they bound it in strips of linen with spices, as the custom of the Jews is to bury. Now, in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden, a new tomb in which no one had yet been laid. So there they laid Jesus because of the Jews' preparation day for their Passover and the beginning of the feast, for the tomb was nearby. In Mark's account in chapter 15, it says Joseph of Arimathea was a member of the council or the Sanhedrin. In Luke's account in chapter 23 of Luke, it says that he, Joseph, did not consent to their decision to have him put to death. They did not consent, even though he was a member of that body. So just a little extra facts along the way there that are added. But all four say what? He was taken, he was given, Joseph of Arimathea went to Pilate, asked for the body, was given permission, and put him in a sepulcher that he owned. And so they all agree, even though one has maybe a little more information than the other, but the story is the same. Now, once he was placed in that tomb, how secure was that tomb? Was it pretty secure? So no problem that anybody could get in. See, that's what a lot of, even the Jews said, yeah, well, look, you got to do something. And they went to Pilate on the holy day and to make sure that everything was taken care of here, that nobody could break in and take it. Let's go to Matthew 27 quickly. Matthew 27. And again, we have such details here of really what was, you don't make this stuff up and come up with a story like this. All right, Matthew 27 and verse 62. On the next day, which followed the day of preparation, the day of preparation is the 14th, that means the next day is the 15th, the chief priests and Pharisees gathered together to Pilate, saying, "Sir, we remember while he was still alive how that deceiver said, 'After 3 days I will rise.' Therefore, command that the tomb be made secure until the third day," last third day from when they're talking to Pilate. They're talking to Pilate on the 15th. The third day then is Sunday, right? Not the third day from yesterday, but the third day from now is what they're saying to him. And they didn't want him, lest his disciples come by night and steal him away and say to the people, "He has risen from the dead," so that the last deception will be worse than the first. He's a deceiver. We don't want them to steal the body and deceive people even more. Pilate said to them, "Well, you have a guard. Go your way. Make it as secure as you know how." So they went and made the tomb secure, sealing the stone and setting the guard. Now that sealing the stone, that seal, all right, what was the sepulcher like? It was small, had a small opening, narrow opening to go in. In other words, you didn't stand up if you're 6 foot tall and think you're going to walk through without bashing your head on the, you got to duck to get in there. Also, it had a trough that came down in an angle like so. And that trough, you put a big stone there that covers the whole opening. It's a round disc stone. And you roll it down, it stops at the bottom. You put another stone behind it as a block. Now, the only way you seal it, because if that seal is broken, that guard is dead. And it better not be broken and removed in any way. To get that, to open it up, you have to remove the block and you need a couple men to roll it back uphill so you can get in. Now, you know the story. The women came to the tomb and what did they find? The thing had been rolled back. And the block put on the other side so it wouldn't come down on them. There's nothing in there. Both the Jews have a problem, and that Roman soldier has a problem too. And so, well, what did they do to resolve that problem? It's right here, chapter 28 of Matthew, verse 11. Now, while they were going, behold, some of the guard came into the city and reported to the chief priests all the things that had happened. You notice they didn't go report to Pilate. They went to the chief priests because they knew they were in big, big, big trouble. Verse 12. When they had assembled with the elders and consulted together, the elders gave a large sum of money to the soldiers, saying to them, "Tell them, his disciples came at night and stole him away while we slept." By the way, that could get you killed too. And if this comes to the governor's ears, Pilate, we will appease him and make you secure. So they took the money and did as they were instructed. And this saying is commonly reported among the Jews until this day. That's how you fix the problem. they had to. It's very interesting, the details here, that Matthew knew about it because Matthew and John were there. And all right. So, the witnesses, you have the four accounts, all of these things, you don't make something like that up. They all agree that's what happened. Joseph Arimathea's tomb is where he was placed. Now, quickly, I have one more thing, and I'll try to get through this as fast as I can. What is the biblical evidence, the third question, of his appearing following the resurrection? Anybody see it? Now, Paul just said 500 people saw it, of which most of them are still alive by the mid-50s. What else in the scriptures do we have? And I'm going to kind of go through these quickly, and if you want, you can write them down and look them up later. But I think it's quite fascinating. One of the answer to the question I just read has already been answered in one scripture, 1 Corinthians 15, verses 3 through 7. But what else? The first couple of ones have to do with women. Who came to the grave? Why didn't the apostles come? The women went, right? The first one, I'll give it to you. Mary Magdalene comes to the grave. Probably when had been a prostitute, had seven demons cast out of her, according to Mark's account and all of that. But you'll find Mary comes to the grave, John chapter 20, verses 10 through 18. The second one is that the other women besides Mary, they come to the grave, Matthew 28, verses 8 through 10. The third one, Cleopas, and another disciple on the road to Emmaus, Luke 24, verses 13 through 32. All right, we haven't got to the apostles yet. There's something quite interesting about the fact that the first three examples of witnesses who came to the grave are women. In the first century, a woman's value in court and testifying versus that of a man was like almost zero. That meant that this is a very humiliating or humbling situation. Peter, James, and John did not come first. The women did, and then they went back to report it. And what does that tell us about the writing of it? That it is accurate. It is accurate. That they report that it was the women who in that period of time would not have had a great deal of recognition as being trustworthy. And yet the apostles, all the accounts say it was the women who came there and they told the truth. And that in itself is a very interesting fact when you look at it, that women, it shows. This event shows that the gospel writers faithfully recorded what happened. They didn't change it in any way whatsoever. Now, the modern women's movement today should take another look. They might even want to become believers because God used women to announce the resurrection. And no, they were not subservient in God's eyes. And he deliberately had it that way. One other point I'd like to mention about Joseph of Arimathea and that tomb. Jesus was innocent. He was not going to be buried. God was not going to allow his son to be buried as a common criminal. And that's why he led Joseph of Arimathea to put him into a sepulcher carved out of the stone rock cliff to bury him there and put him ahead. In other words, a proper and decent burial, as we would express it today. All right, I gave you three examples of people seeing the resurrection: Mary Magdalene, other women, Cleopas, and the other disciples on the road to Emmaus. Then we have number four, 11 disciples, along with others, in Luke 24, verse 33 through 49. They see him, and he talks to them. Number five, the 10 apostles and others, with Thomas being absent, see Jesus as he appears to them in John 20, verse 19 through 23. Then you have seven apostles who see him, John 21, verses 1 through 14. then he comes to the disciples, Matthew 28, 16 through 20. Then he was with the disciples at the Mount of Olives before his ascension. You see that in Acts 1, verse 4 through 9. All these things. I mean, how you have multiple men and women seeing him. He appeared to them for 40 days after the resurrection. The book of Acts is filled with references to Jesus' appearance. Luke writes about him all throughout as they go to the churches. The first one is in Acts 2, verse 32, where Peter said, Acts 2:32, of which we are witnesses, he said in that sermon he gave. The next chapter, chapter 3, verse 15, of which we are witnesses, he again declares. Acts 10, verse 41, but to witnesses chosen before my God. To witnesses chosen before my God. Two more. Acts 13, verse 31. Who are his witnesses to the people? And Paul, when he is saying this, he is in Asia Minor on his first tour. Who are witnesses to the people? We are, is what he is saying. And finally, Acts 26, at the end of the book almost, verse 24 through 26. And here, Paul, being on trial, you might say, there in Palestine, says, since this thing was not done in a corner, it's in the open. And there are multiple witnesses. Well, God provided multiple witnesses. The resurrection cannot be dismissed because there were only a couple of witnesses at best who gave questionable accounts. There are many witnesses. The Bible says to prove all things and hold fast to that which is good. Our Father has left all generations since the coming of Christ with an unusual amount of first-hand evidence for the resurrection. As we approach the Passover, hopefully this evidence will give us a much greater appreciation for the importance of the resurrection.